This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. I think I need some starters, because mine are all worn out. I also need a catcher who can throw and doesn't pout, and I could use a lefty in relief, a closer too, but everybody needs that stuff, so what am I to do? So goes the lament of the general manager circa summer 2005. Joining me now to talk of trades and other baseball matters on this Hall of Fame weekend is ESPN's Tim Kirchen, who is, not surprisingly, in Cooperstown, New York. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
How you doing, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Ryan Sandberg and Wade Boggs will be inducted into the Hall tomorrow. Every major sport has its Hall of Fame, and a lot of the minor sports do as well. But what makes the Baseball Hall of Fame special?
Well, it's baseball is the richest sport there is as far as tradition and history and everything else. And the way that Cooperstown is run is just so spectacularly good in every way that when you come here, it's all about baseball. With all due respect to hockey, I went to the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto last year, and it's like located in a mall. You know, it's like a big store inside a mall. That's the whole Hockey Hall of Fame. And I'm thinking, how could this be? Plus, the Football Hall of Fame, as great as that is, and basketball, as great as that is, I just think when you set aside an entire town like this and say, this is only about baseball, that's what makes it so great.
Tomorrow also marks the trade deadline. Teams have until 4 p.m. to make the blockbuster deal that will absolutely guarantee a trip to the World Series. Are you surprised that there hasn't been more dealing to this point?
Well, I am a little bit, although we have to keep in mind, Bill, this has been a pretty weak year for the trade deadline. I had to do a list the other day for ESPN of the top three guys who would probably go in the trade deadline, and one was Denys Baez of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, two was Matt Lawton of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and three was Mark Redmond of the Pittsburgh Pirates. Not exactly the sexiest names out there, but those were the three guys that I thought had the best chance to move. Number four was A.J. Burnett, who is a big name, but he is quite frankly the only big name who might move, and he might not move after all.
What looked to be, or was for a time, the feel-good story of the year, the former Montreal Traveling Expos, now the Washington Nationals, is no longer such a warm and fuzzy story. The free-falling Nats are out of first place in the National League East. They could miss the playoffs, or can they turn it around?
No, Bill, they're going to miss the playoffs, and I hate to say that because even though I root for no one, and that's sincere, they're my hometown team from way back, and right now they stink. They've lost eight consecutive one-run games. They used to be 23-7 in one-run games, and now all those close games that they won, now they're losing them, and that is the sign of a team in deep trouble. Keep in mind, Bill, this team is last in the major leagues in runs scored. It is a miracle they still are where they are. That is in contention. 210 teams in history, Bill, have finished last in their league in runs scored. None of the 210 ever went to the playoffs. None of the 210 ever won 90 games, and only 10 out of 210 ever had a winning record. So it just shows you, if you don't score runs, you're not going anywhere. And unfortunately for the Nats, they haven't scored any runs for about a month and a half now.
And the team that the Nats now trail, the Atlanta Braves, looking to win their 74th consecutive division title, I think it is. Should we be surprised at this point that Atlanta is where it is?
We shouldn't be, Bill. I mean, it's a great story that they are where they are because the adversity they faced this year is unlike any other year. And people forget how much adversity this team has faced over the years. It hasn't been the same guys winning the division title every year. They tinker, they mess with the team, they figure it out, and this year they've had to do more of that than any other year, and it is the ultimate tribute to Bobby Cox, who has been a Hall of Fame manager in my mind for the last 5 years, and to general manager John Schuerholz, and to the whole organization. Every time they draft a kid, they want to draft a high school kid, develop them on their own, let their instructors teach them how to play, as opposed to developing all those bad habits in college baseball. And when those guys get to be 21 and 22 years old in the Braves system, they're ready. And this year they were ready, and that's a good thing because they've used about 12 rookies this year.
The Chicago White Sox continue to dominate the American League Central Division, Minnesota and Cleveland chasing them, but nobody's going to catch them, right?
Right. The White Sox are going to win the division. I don't know more than one person who picked them to win the division. I, of course, had them third, so I'll be looking real good in October. I've already given up on that one. The White Sox, Bill, are really good. They send out a quality starting pitcher every single night, which is very rare in baseball today. Plus, they're still looking for more help. They actually are trying to get A.J. Burnett from the Marlins. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's the White Sox general manager, Kenny Williams, saying, hey, we haven't won the World Series since 1917. We have to do something extraordinary here, and even though we have a great team, we can't rest. We have to get better, and that's why they're being aggressive at this time of year.
All right, how about this one? Their staff ace is now their closer and not a particularly dependable one. Their best hitter has been known to climb into the scoreboard between pitches, and now he's asking to be traded. And those are just a few of the distractions the Red Sox have endured since winning the World Series last fall. And yet, they find themselves atop the American League East. Do they stay there?
I think they can stay there, but believe me, I am baffled by this team. I'm especially baffled by Manny Ramirez, although we shouldn't be baffled by Manny Ramirez's trade request or anything else that he says or does, because he's Manny Ramirez. Keep in mind, Bill, when he was almost traded to the Texas Rangers 2 years ago for Alex Rodriguez, and then Rodriguez, of course, was traded to the Yankees instead, Manny went up to A-Rod that following spring when A-Rod was with the Yankees, and he put his arm around him and he said, Alex, geez, it really would have been great if you could have been with us this year. Manny not even understanding that if A-Rod had been with him, Manny would have been somewhere else.
Well, Manny had another trade in mind. It
right.
was obvious.
That's what we're dealing with here with Manny Ramirez. And even though this trade request appears to be legitimate and the Red Sox are actually looking into it, I just cannot believe that you trade the RBI leader in the American League in the middle of a pennant race, especially when you're guaranteed not to get very much back for him given how much money is owed on his contract.
The Yankees looked old and tired and out of contention back in the spring, but here they are with a whole bunch of pitchers who didn't used to be wearing Yankee uniforms. Do we see them back in the postseason?
You know, I still think they're going to make it, and I may be hopelessly off on this one, but they're still the Yankees. They still have Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera, and they still have Joe Torre. And when I see those guys, I just look and say, they're going to make it, and I think they will. However, you could easily build a case that they're not, that they're still old and slow, and all these pitchers they brought in, none of them is any good. That's certainly a possibility. However, I think they're going to find a way to hit their way through this, and I think they're going to make the playoffs, but don't ask me who's not going to make the playoffs if they do, because I've got way too many teams going to the playoffs at this point.
Now they have to change the system.
Right, we'll have 7 playoff teams in the American League.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill.
A month ago, an hour or so before a game between the Cleveland Indians and the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park, Cleveland pitcher Jake Westbrook sat in the visitors' dugout and watched the fans file into what would be another full house. He couldn't help thinking about the good not-so-long-ago days at Jacobs Field in Cleveland, and he assured me that, yes, he and his teammates are aware of the difference between a packed stadium and a place where a ball hit into the stands might bounce around for a while before anybody picks it up.
We definitely notice it. I mean, especially if you were a part of it when we were selling out. It was a lot of fun coming to the park when the place was packed out every night. But you definitely know it that the place is not full. But I think they're starting to come back out for us, and which is nice.
The Jake, as Jacobs Field is called, was in fact packed out for a major league record 455 games between 1995 and 2001. During which time the park was still a novelty and the Indians were, for the most part, contenders. 42,000-plus showed up each night. Terry Pluto, who covers the Indians for the Akron Beacon Journal, says that stretch was unprecedented.
Good team coming out of a bad ballpark into a wonderful ballpark, and Jacobs Field is still terrific. And a steady star for baseball. At the same time, the Cleveland Browns had moved to Baltimore. I don't know how you could line all those stars up again.
They have not lined up for the Indians this summer. Cleveland, struggling to stay above 500, has fallen more than a dozen games behind the White Sox in the American League's Central Division. Attendance at Jacobs Field, one of the first Back to the Future ballparks, has sagged to about half of what the Indians were enjoying during the sellout streak, and critics have pointed out that the grand and glorious benefits the stadium was supposed to bestow on a needy city haven't appeared. People in the Kinsman neighborhood of Cleveland were told the stadium would bring renewal to their area, but according to Daniel Rosenzweig, the author of a study of baseball's newest stadia entitled Retro Ballparks, the hype was hollow.
They were promised help for their schools. They were promised that the stadium was going to be a virtual economic panacea for services in the city, and that really hasn't materialized. Shortly after the Indians signed their contract with the city, they were granted a tax abatement in perpetuity.
Rosenzweig acknowledges that Jacobs Field, stocked with delightful comestibles and microbrewery beers, is a clean, safe place to enjoy a ball game, but he compares the Jake to an even better-known park in terms of the atmosphere the folks running the Indians are trying to create and the people they've hired to help create it.
They try to find a kind of wholesome, clean-cut workforce that always kind of gives off a cheery appearance, and that's similar to Disney. The Imagineers at Disney World understand that people go to Disney to escape from the everyday life. And so they try to put forward a workforce that's always happy.
Another similarity between Jacobs Field and Disneyland is that both maintain state-of-the-art surveillance everywhere on the premises. But the feature of the Jake and other ballparks like it that Rosenzweig and others find most discouraging is the ersatz quality of the experience they create. Old ballparks offered fans an escape from drudgery, too, but the old ballparks were authentic parts of the cities that contained them, not simulations of charming venues that were never really venues at all. Despite such objections, or perhaps because of them, for a time, Jacobs Field worked brilliantly. But unhappily for the Indians, 11 years after its unveiling, Jacobs Field is apparently not the attraction it once was. Maybe that's because a dozen other major league teams have built retro parks. More likely, it's because the Indians, who've made a couple of false starts toward rebuilding since the team dominated the Central Division during the mid and late 90s, just aren't as good as they were a few years back. The various recent gimmicks the Indians have invoked to increase attendance notwithstanding, veteran baseball writer Terry Pluto says you can't avoid the cliché.
Well, they had a dour hot dog day on 4th of July with a day-night doubleheader, and they drew 28,000 and 31,000 for the two games. For $10, you could probably end up needing Pepto-Bismol, but, you know, you could have a lot of hot dogs. But, Bill, you know, somebody said to me, oh, the bottom line is the bottom line. And the bottom line in baseball, still winning games.
The Indians will next try to win a game this afternoon. They'll play the Mariners in Seattle. Jacobs Field will next throw open its new old gates on Tuesday night when Cleveland will host the Yankees in Game 1 of a 3-game series. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Major League Soccer takes a break to celebrate its stars. But first, on Sunday, Lance Armstrong rode to an unprecedented 7th consecutive Tour de France victory, though few would dispute Armstrong's place in history as the greatest Tour de France rider. There is still much debate over which cyclist should be considered the greatest of all time. Sadie Babbitts was in France for the 2005 Tour, and she has this report.
A British cyclist who calls himself Froot takes a break from climbing the first mountain stage of this year's Tour de France from Grenoble to Courchevel. Sweat drips from his face as this brightly clad rider plunges his helmet into an outdoor fountain.
It's got to be the way to do it.
This village waterhole is a stopping place for hundreds of cycling tourists as they make their way up the mountain. Already, thousands of people have lined the steep, twisting road just to see riders on this stage of the tour, especially Lance Armstrong. Froot says before Armstrong, these mountain stages had few spectators. Now, they're everywhere.
He's awesome. He's an incredible guy. And he's opened up cycling to a population that just never understood it before. So what he's done is stunning. And for years I've thought, I don't know, it's like, I wish one day he'd have a race, you know, someone actually take him on. And kind of looking at it, you think, maybe people are taking him on and he is actually that good. For riding the Tour, he's the best there is.
Lance Armstrong stood on the podium one final time last Sunday as the American flag rose over Paris. And from the center of the Champs-Élysées, he gave a speech, something never done before by a Tour winner.
I'm a fan of the Tour de France for as long as I live, and there are no secrets. This is a hard sporting event, and hard work wins it. So, vive la Tour, forever. Thank you.
The Italian press immediately heralded him as a cycling legend. Another European paper claimed he now belongs to an elite group of athletes, which includes seven-time Wimbledon tennis champion Pete Sampras and seven-time Olympic swimming gold medalist Mark Spitz. It's Armstrong's mental toughness that many believe has made him the greatest Tour de France rider. Discovery Channel team spokesman Yogi Mueller says nobody in this year's Tour de France peloton had Armstrong's determination.
Lance is so strong mentally. He can focus so hard that there's nobody who can beat him. The physical capacity, sure, you could probably measure certain, you know, in tests, you can measure certain things, but I think to come back seven times and be this well prepared, you need to be determined like I have not seen anybody else being.
There have been a handful of multiple-year Tour de France winners. From 1969 to 1972, Belgian Eddy Merckx dominated the Tour de France. He lost in 1973, but he came back to win a fifth Tour in 1974. Merckx is often considered the world's greatest cyclist because he also won some 500 pro races, including the Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta a España. In 1991, Spanish racer Miguel Indurain won the Tour de France, and he kept winning it for the next 4 years. But Mueller says cycling has changed, and gone are the days when racers try to win every pro race.
You have to prepare races, or you have to pick your moments when you want to be good. And there's rarely a guy like Bettini who maybe in one season wins many different races. But you pay that a season later if you go out for this long.
Mueller, who used to race as a pro, has known Armstrong since the early 90s, when Lance was just a young Texan who wanted to be a successful cyclist in Europe.
And I think he definitely proved everybody who either didn't believe in him or thought, you know, it's some little Texan kid coming here. Because we heard a lot from this young Texan kid who was supposed to be a big talent, you know, and as the Europeans pros are, they, you know, snotty, kind of snotty too, saying, you know, let him come. He came and conquered.
He conquered so much, other riders dubbed him the boss. Morgan Neal, who owns Oval, a company that designs bike equipment, says Armstrong is a man who deserves respect.
I mean, everybody looks at him and just expects him to be there. He goes out and he defeats them before the tour begins. And you put that shred of doubt in people's mind and that they can't do it. And he's done that. That's what makes you the boss.
But not everyone agrees Armstrong is the best Tour de France cyclist. In a small village just outside Grenoble, this sheep farmer explains he's never liked Lance Armstrong.
I don't like him because I suspect that he abuses illicit substances. How can someone be that good without assistance?
But even those who don't like Armstrong seem to have a certain respect for him. Peter and his friend Herbert came from Germany to follow this year's tour. They both acknowledge Armstrong is an incredible rider, but Peter says he's not his favorite.
He is looking only to his own success. He doesn't rest with the other riders. And I think he is not so popular, especially in France.
Suzanne Halliburton is a sports writer for the Austin American-Statesman, a Texas newspaper based in Armstrong's hometown. She's been following Armstrong since he developed testicular cancer in 1996. Halliburton says his recovery from cancer and seven consecutive Tour de France wins have made him an icon. But she believes those achievements aren't enough to make him the sport's greatest rider.
I don't think he's going to go down as the best cyclist ever because most people think Eddy Merckx is, because Merckx did all the races and dominated all the races, and Lance specialized in the Tour.
Now that Armstrong's pro career is over, many wonder which American cyclist will make a bid for the yellow jersey. Cycle Sport magazine photographer Phil O'Connor has been covering the tour for 25 years. He believes there are a few Americans who could win the tour at least once.
You've got Lee Farmer, I still think Juliet can do a good ride, and you've got Floyd Landis as well. So the opportunities for the hole to be filled are definitely there, and I think America's involvement in the tour is definitely not over.
Italian Ivan Basso and Germany's Jan Ulrich, who both stood on the podium at the Champs-Élysées last weekend, are considered favorites to win a Tour de France. And Kazakhstan's national champion, Alexander Vinokurov, who came in fifth overall in this year's tour, wants to try for the yellow within the next 2 years. As for Lance Armstrong's future, he now begins the transition from life on the bike to life on 2 feet. That may include a bid for Texas governor in 2006. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
Major League Soccer's All-Star Game this weekend marks the midpoint of the league's 10th season. It also signifies another in the long line of All-Star Game experiments. Joining me now to discuss that and various other MLS matters is ESPN soccer commentator Seamus Mallon. Seamus, what a delight to have you back at Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
We have discussed the shifting shape of the MLS All-Star experience before. How do you like an All-Star game that pits the best players in Major League Soccer against one of the not-quite-premier teams from England's Premiership?
Well, this is a competition, if that's what you want to call it, that has been on shifting sands, and I wonder if it might be better off on quicksand, because I am not a big fan of the All-Star game. I think it's a corporate exercise for the most part, and that I sort of get. So, you know, they experimented last time with a match against Chivas, and they have had various novelties. And this one is kind of a potential winner in that it brings in Fulham, where there are two ex-MLS players playing, Bocanegra and McBride.
It brings McBride back to his previous home club.
Right, exactly. They did have a warm-up match with the Columbus Crew, and sadly Fulham lost it. Now, the Crew are struggling, and they used a lot of young players. If Fulham is going to not provide as much opposition to the Columbus Crew sort of B-ish team, you wonder if they will really rise to the occasion. One hopes they will for the All-Star event.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because besides the Fulham game at Columbus, in other international action, AC Milan beat the Chicago Fire 3-1 in D.C. United broke on top against Chelsea in a game but lost 2-1. What, if anything, do these games mean as far as the maturity and progress of MLS?
Oh, I think they're fantastic. Now, I have been an advocate of this kind of tournament for years. And I think the absence of it is in many ways a continuing knee-jerk legacy of MLS to do nothing that the NASL did. The NASL did this and did it very well. It was called the Trans-America Cup, and they brought in – Transatlantic Cup, rather. They brought in teams from all over Europe to play against the best of the NASL. And they were crowd-pleasers. They were exciting games. They were preseason training for players from Europe. And the locals really rose to the occasion. The locals, that is, the teams. I think Chicago and D.C. in these last two nights have shown that they have the capacity to compete against a top-level team, in fairness, in their preseason mode. But nonetheless, I think this is what needs to be done, and just have the courage to go and do more of it.
When teams like AC Milan and Chelsea and Manchester United has also been in country this summer, as has Real Madrid, when U.S. soccer fans get to see teams like this play, do they come away from the experience with an even greater appreciation for the game, or do they come away thinking, oh, gosh, what we're seeing on a daily basis is a little bit limp compared to this?
Well, that is the risk, of course, but I think it's less of a risk now because the matches that these teams can be seen on cable television week in and week out. I think that is doing more damage to attendance necessarily than a one-off appearance when they come over. When they come over, I think all the locals, the expats, the people who have adopted these teams as Americans will plunk down excessive numbers of dollars, by the way, to go watch and play just to be in the presence of these people, even though they know it's preseason. And in the Milan-Chelsea game in Gillette Stadium, it was very clear that Chelsea were 2 weeks ahead of Milan in their training because their season starts 2 weeks ahead of the Italians. I think people put that aside. They're just so happy to see these phenoms that they'll come out. And I, and if the local teams do well, as they have done, I think it has the opposite effect. People say, you know, these guys aren't bad. We should come see them play more often.
At the All-Star break, the two least accomplished MLS teams are the two expansion teams, Chivas USA and Real Salt Lake, which I still can't quite say without smiling a little bit. Anyway, not so long ago, an expansion team could expect to contend for a championship in this league. So I guess that's no longer the case.
Yeah, this has been a bit of a disappointment. The good news for Salt Lake is that the fans are hanging in there. The Chivas situation in Los Angeles is more complicated by virtue of the fact that they share the stadium with the Galaxy, and they're trying to build that rivalry, but they really have not done a good job in packing their team with good Spanish talent or Hispanic talent or Latin American talent. And it is there, but it's costly. And that's been part of the problem. I think that the young players coming through for the other teams now, the young Americans, are really making an impact on this league, which is what that league was all about. But there is a finite number of them still, and so I don't think the talent is as deep as it looks to the national team, which it certainly is when you put it to league-wide basis. So this is a little bit of a disappointment, but on the other hand, I think the attitude in the league is full steam ahead. We're looking for more expansion, and I think that's the way to go, because I think the game is going to build from its 10th year on and be a strong league.
Seamus, over the first half of the season, the most successful teams have been the aforementioned New England Revolution, the Chicago Fire, FC Dallas, San Jose. You like any of those four as a 2005 MLS champion?
Well, I do, yeah. I like Dallas very much. I was highly impressed and entertained by the way they played. But I also like New England, again, because New England is building a team now that does not concede many goals. They run into a little bit of a rough patch of late, but the coach there has really done a terrific job in providing what he knows best, which is how to defend, and he's got those players defending. And it is true that defending in many ways builds championships. But Dallas has been shipping goals of late, and they need to tighten things up. But going forward, they are the speediest, most entertaining side, I think, in the league. And the surprises, I would be surprised, frankly, if San Jose keeps up this pace. I expect L.A. to make a late run, and Chicago likewise. But my top two would still be Dallas and New England.
Seamus Mellon is a soccer commentator for ESPN, and he joins me here at Only a Game from time to time as well. Seamus, thank you very much.
Pleasure as always, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game. Zach Dillon, who hears Only a Game on KPBS in San Diego, wrote in response to a story about race walking on the July 16th show. Mr. Dillon questioned the point of race walking, a competition that he characterized as getting from the start to the finish as fast as you can, but only in a certain way. By that logic, Mr. Dillon continued, in 2008, why not the crab walk or the three-legged race? I once heard an interview with an Olympic race walker, and when asked what form of movement he would use if being chased, he said he would run. Enough said. Last week's show reprised a story about the difficulties faced by people singing the Star-Spangled Banner at sporting events. Kate Gladstone, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, wrote to say, quote, "The story unintentionally descended into irony when the man who crusades for all Americans to learn to sing the national anthem erred twice on the lyrics of the anthem's third verse. Instead of vauntingly in that verse's first line, he said valiantly, and instead of footsteps in the fourth line, he simply said steps." What irony. We said it was hard. As part of that national anthem story, I spoke with Renee Rancourt, who has been singing the national anthem at the Boston Bruins games for more than 25 years. Susan Sheridan, who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, wrote, "I would like to contact Mr. Rancourt. I would like to get a recording of him singing the Canadian anthem to play at our house now that the NHL is back." Ms. Sheridan, if you ask politely, Mr. Rancourt will probably come out to your house and give you O Canada in person. He's just like that. Who did that great bowling song on your show last week? Asked Brian O'Neill in an email, and he wasn't alone. Keith Severson, who hears the program on Minnesota Public Radio, wrote, "That bowling song had me laughing out loud. It sounded like some of my cheese-headed Wisconsin neighbors perpetuating a stereotype." The song in question is Bowling and Beer, recorded in 1999 by the Youpers on a CD entitled Jack Pine Savage. You can email us by tapping in only a game at wbur.bu.edu. You can more easily reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Bowling and beer, bowling and beer. Yeah. Fill up our mugs with fun and good cheer. Yeah. Bowling and beer, bowling and beer. God put us here for bowling and beer. Hey!
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, getting to know the American swimmers whose initials don't read MP. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who joins us from the studios of WUWM in Milwaukee for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
It's a great day by a great lake.
Well, what's up in Milwaukee? The Brewers getting ready to make a run at the pennant?
I am actually going to be making my Miller Park debut on Sunday, but alas and alack, it's my 30th college reunion.
We won't talk about what it would be for me. Basketball coach for life Larry Brown celebrated landing what he called his dream job this week. Wasn't the Detroit Pistons' appearance in two consecutive NBA finals, including a title in 2004, dreamy enough?
Oh, Larry, shut up. This is now a modus operandi, not a charming eccentricity. You went to New York because it's a new team you can rebuild and get credit for rebuilding, plus you've got 60 million reasons why it's a good thing to be back home. the romance of Larry Brown's inability to stay put for very long has left me at least about two stops ago.
Isaiah Thomas also said it may have been the greatest thing he'd ever done.
Probably true, actually, considering that he's spent most of his career running other things into the ground.
On Thursday, Bob Goodenow resigned as head of the National Hockey League Players Association. For gosh sakes, why'd he do that?
Well, once you've achieved all your goals, there's just no more mountains to climb. I mean, when you've succeeded in utterly destroying your union.
Impoverishing your workers for all time.
And arranging a collective bargaining agreement that would have embarrassed Andrew Carnegie, what more is there to do in the year 2005?
Over the past week or so, NHL Players Association President Trevor Linden and some player reps from various NHL teams have insisted that their new deal really is an equitable one and that they have entered into a real partnership with the league. You don't buy this, do you?
Yeah. Look, you have to put the best possible face on this disaster, and that's what they're trying to do. I think their most important decision right now is who do they bring in to replace Bob Goodenow, who's going to try to make this thing palatable and try to nibble around the edges while the world's dumbest management ownership class now doesn't have to think at all.
As its first order of business after ratifying the new collective bargaining agreement last Friday, the National Hockey League held its draft lottery, and I understand that as a TV show, the event was not entirely compelling.
Well, I think the fake mustaches and funny noses and secret code words you needed to get into the speakeasy where they held it was probably a drawback to general kind of massive popular entertainment. But, Sidney Crosby was the one guy anybody had ever heard of, and we'd actually heard of him before the league immolated itself. The only real interest was how or whether they were going to fix it so he somehow wound up with the Rangers. He didn't, so all is well.
No, he wound up with the Pittsburgh Penguins, and has there ever been more pressure on a single young man to save the skins of everybody with whom he works?
Well, I think, yes, in the history of the National Hockey League, there certainly has been. I think there's no question that the succeeding generations from Richard to Geoffrion to Béliveau in Montreal faced the same, if not the same, media pressure, certainly the same cultural pressure that this guy will face.
Four Andretti Green Racing Team members boycotted a mandatory autographing session at Sunday's Milwaukee Mile Indy Car Race, which was their way of protesting the attention and preferential treatment that they feel Danica Patrick receives. That gesture is certainly ill-considered. Is it self-destructive as well?
Well, they're still talking about it at the corner of 3rd and Wisconsin out here, let me tell you. I mean, they're just horrified. Look, there's nothing the Indy Racing League can do to screw up that it hasn't already done. Now, for the first time in recent memory, people are actually interested in it. Are they interested in it because of the fluky appearance of Danica Patrick? Absolutely. Should the other drivers suck it up and realize that it's as good for them as it is for her? Absolutely. Will they? Of course not.
This would have been like baseball players in the 20s and early 30s getting mad at Babe Ruth for making so much money.
Well, actually,
right?
It's more precisely like the grumbling that attended the first appearance of Tiger Woods on the PGA Tour, which also took place. His first professional tournament, by the way, was the Greater Milwaukee Open. See, it all comes back to the shores of the Milwaukee and the Menominee.
Apparently.
But what happened in golf was that the real old guys, the old guys with the skins on the wall, Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Tom Watson, all got up to the young, boring, anonymous millionaires and said, shut up, this guy's going to make you all a lot of money. And they did, and he did.
NFL training camps are in full swing, and I'm sure...
I thought I heard some cheering in the background.
Yes, and
there,
some
Bill.
Thundering, and I'm sure players are as delighted as the fans about this. Baseball goes to Florida and Arizona for training camps. Why doesn't the NFL go to Antarctica?
Football is practiced in the heat so that it can be played well in the cold.
Ah.
It's one of the many things about football that makes no sense on the surface, but makes perfect sense when you watch these guys try to run into each other in the middle of December, a few degrees north of here in Green Bay.
2 weeks ago, we discussed the fact that having been snubbed this year, Paris will not bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. Chicago, however, will make a bid. Do you think Mayor Richard Daley knows what he's getting into?
Well, since the local federal prosecutor is chasing everybody Richard Daley ever had a phone conversation with in the last 5 years, I think the guy needed a distraction, and he's got one here. It's as bad an idea in Chicago as it ever was in New York. The Olympics should be overseas. Let the people have them. Let Paris have them. Let Tashkent have them. Let, for example, Antarctica have them.
South African Maurice Creswick has once more extended his own mark in the Guinness Book of World Records. Charlie, Mr. Creswick has now donated blood for the 350th time, and if all goes according to schedule, he will donate for time number 351 in about 2 months. I wonder when somebody will gently take him aside as he has his cookies and juice and say, enough.
It's possible he really likes the juice, but if you're going to have competitions where you have blood dopers, you might as well have competitions where you have blood philanthropists.
And finally, Charlie, Lincoln, Nebraska resident Bryce Mellon beats everybody at video games that involve cutting off the limbs of cyber opponents and exploding their heads. That wouldn't be especially remarkable, except for the fact that Mellon is blind. Should we and the WHO feel especially good about this?
Absolutely. He sure plays a mean Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Additionally, he's not going to take it. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
You may have noticed last night when Michael Phelps won his fourth gold medal at the World Swimming Championships in Montreal in the 4x200 freestyle relay. You may even have noticed when Aaron Pearsall won the 200-meter backstroke, breaking his own world record and sweeping the backstroke events again. But did you notice on Monday when 16-year-old Katie Hoff won gold in the 200-meter individual medley? Or on Tuesday when Tara Kirk took home the bronze in the 100-meter breaststroke, or even on Wednesday when Larson Jensen set a new American record in his second-place finish in the 800-meter freestyle. Only a Game's Karen Given noticed, and she has our report from Montreal.
Two Fridays ago, Michael Phelps was welcomed to Montreal in a manner fitting the sport's biggest celebrity on the red carpet at the world premiere of a new documentary starring Michael Phelps. Phelps wore a tan suit and flip-flops. At times, it seems like Phelps is the only swimmer on the American team, like earlier that day when the coaches gathered to answer questions from the media.
Alexander Bleich, German television. Bob, could you tell us something about Michael?
The first three questions were addressed to Bob Bowman, Michael Phelps' personal coach. After leaving the podium, Bowman was mobbed by journalists from every corner of the globe, while men's head coach Dave Salo was virtually ignored, a situation that didn't seem to bother him.
I think this room would be half full if Michael Phelps wasn't part of our program. Michael brings certainly a lot of presence to our sport, and everybody appreciates that. I think the athletes are learning to appreciate that. As soon as the attention's gone, we lose out.
Most of the capacity crowd was gone by the time the team captains arrived, which was a shame, because the world missed the opportunity to hear about the life goals of Tara Kirk, who might not be the team's best breaststroker, but she's quite possibly the most studious.
Well, my heroes are people like Paul Farmer and D.A. Henderson. You know, D.A. Henderson was the person who thought up the way to eliminate smallpox from the world. So, I don't know if I would like to follow them and sort of like try to eliminate or at least greatly reduce some horrible disease like malaria or something like that, but it's a completely different world, that world of infectious disease, from this world of, international swimming. So it's hard to sort of figure out exactly how I'm going to blend, the two.
This spring, Kirk finished her thesis comparing the spread of avian influenza to the pandemic of 1918, received her master's degree from Stanford University in anthropological sciences, and found time to train and qualify for the world championships in the 100 and 200 meter breaststroke. Tara Kirk knows better than to take Michael Phelps on in the pool, even if breaststroke is his worst discipline. So is there anything not related to infectious diseases she does better than Michael Phelps?
Michael Phelps is pretty cool, but I don't know. I might be better at cooking, although I'm not good at cooking, so I can't really. I've been improving. I made baked figs. I made banana bread. I was impressed with myself.
A day before the swimming competition begins, athletes from Africa take laps in the competition pool while backstroker Aaron Pearsall looks on. A sometime surfer from Southern California currently attending college in Texas, Pearsall lists lounging by the pool as his favorite pastime, which is ironic considering he spends 3 hours a day, 6 days a week, staring at the black line while he trains.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that. I mean, it's cool to know, and it's great to know that you can, finish what you're doing, drop what you're doing in the day, and go back to sit by a pool on a hot day and not think about swimming. You're just kind of using it to get wet. So I know I'm not completely sick of the sport yet. I can enjoy sitting by a pool or sitting by a large body of water all day long.
It's easy to see why Pearsall has a reputation for being the most laid-back member of the team. He describes his upcoming races as, quote, nothing to worry about. He talks wistfully of his vacation home in Costa Rica, and he doesn't concern himself with the fact that most people were too busy watching Michael Phelps win 8 medals at the Athens Olympics to notice when he dominated the backstroke events, winning 3 golds and a silver.
No, not at all. I mean, I was proud to be there and to witness what he did, I mean, not too many people can actually say they were there, No, I'd rather be second place to a guy who won 8 medals than to a guy who won 4 golds, And that's the honest truth.
Although he might have been beaten in the medal count, Pearsall doesn't have any trouble coming up with situations, virtual or otherwise, where Phelps is likely to find himself in second place.
Tiger Woods. Oh, I crush him at Tiger Woods. Are you kidding me? Oh, poker, too. He's a pretty good little poker player, but I think I could take him, too. If I can't take him in the pool, I'll take his money, Yeah.
Later in the day, distance freestyler Larson Jensen has returned to the team's hotel in downtown Montreal after an afternoon of hanging out at the mall. For Jensen, competition week is almost like a vacation. Michael Phelps might have once gone 5 years without taking a day off from practice, But on paper, at least, no one trains more than Larson Jensen. During his most intense periods, Jensen swims 2.5 hours at a stretch, sometimes twice a day, averaging 100,000 meters, or 62 miles, a week.
It's a good amount of swimming, yeah. But on top of that, I like to do some running or spinning or cycling, and also do have a core strength weight program that I really like. And I just like pushing my body to its fullest extent, and then keep pushing. That's just what I like to do. And so I'm like a racehorse, I guess, one of my coaches says, and I just, you know, run till they go dead, and that's what I like to do. I don't know why, I just like to push my body until it doesn't go anymore.
Jensen swims the 800 and 1500 meter freestyle at a pace most people would call a sprint. Like most of the members of the American swim team, Jensen says sleeping is his favorite way to relax.
Yeah, well, I do enjoy sleep. I mean, it's fun, but sometimes you don't really have time for it. You know? No rest for the wicked, I guess. You know, wake up pretty early in the school year, wake up around 5:30, get to work out, you know, go 6 to 8, work out, and you know, class virtually all day. Sometimes you have time for a nap, but a lot of times it's really hard to fit in, and work out again in the afternoon, and then the next time it's all over again in the morning.
Larson Jensen took home silver in the 1500-meter freestyle in Athens, but at 19, he says there's still time for him to become the best in the world, and he doesn't have any trouble finding something he does better than Michael Phelps.
I'm better than Michael Phelps at the 1500 and 800 freestyle. He's a good athlete. You can't take anything away from the guy at all. I mean, he's just a magnificent person and a great athlete, and the attention he's getting is well-deserved. The attention the sport's getting, it's great. It's about time swimming starts getting some recognition, even if it is for one individual. Maybe it'll branch out sooner or later.
Early on Sunday morning, athletes cram 10 to a lane to loosen up before the first day of the swimming competition. Somewhere in the stadium, Katie Hoff tries to shake off the nervousness she's felt since the Athens Olympics. The comparisons between Katie Hoff and Michael Phelps come easy. At just over 15, Hoff was the youngest member of the entire U.S. delegation in Athens. When he was 15, Phelps was the youngest male Olympian in Sydney. Neither won a medal in their first games. Hoff and Phelps are both multidiscipline swimmers with multiple national titles. And like Phelps did when he was her age, 16-year-old Hoff trains 7 days a week. Still breathless from her first heat of the 200-meter individual medley, Hoff stops briefly to consider the comparisons.
Michael is an amazing swimmer, so it's always an honor to be compared to him.
And do you want the kind of attention he gets someday?
I don't know. I'm just going to try to do my best, and whatever comes with that, comes with that.
Michael Phelps, Katie Hoff, Larson Jensen, Aaron Pearsall, Tara Kirk, and the other 38 members of the U.S. national team finish up at the World Championships tomorrow. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Montreal.
With a little bit of action, you can be doing the swim now. Just move like a fish and wiggle right up to him now.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help from Amanda Shaloub at WUWM in Milwaukee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to check out photos of the World Swimming Championships, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Tour de France spectator Herbert Timo, who compares his countryman, Tour de France runner-up Jan Ullrich, to Lance Armstrong.
It is a contrast, and sometimes you drink a beer, and so he's totally opposite to the character of Lance Armstrong.
Timo was in France researching his upcoming book, tentatively titled Cycles and Suds, a comparative study of Tour de France riders and their consumption of the nectar otherwise known as beer. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Splash.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.